Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for October 26, 2017. And tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking about the sounds from outer space and some aspects of this, kind of a psychological aspect, which is very interesting. If you did an investigation, for example, when they do investigations of, say, people that say they've sensed Bigfoot right next to them. That's a great example. The psychologists examine the people, question them, and they look for things, especially if they do hypnosis, they look for things like, did they smell something or did they hear sounds? Because your mind cannot create smell memories. So I'll be getting into that topic a little bit later in the show. First of all, a couple announcements. We have had some activity with water filters going to relief agencies. So this always happens. And right now, as I speak, pretty much we're recovering from that. And so that's a little bit of a, and by the way, I don't make a nickel off of any of this or even a penny. So what happens is the relief agencies never store anything up. They don't have any supplies, which is absurd. This is more than absurd, but this is what always happens. And so they come running to all of the water filter suppliers. And of course, Coca-Cola and Pepsi love this because they get to sell voluminous amounts of bottled water, which is the relief agency standard, which is, you know, beyond absurd. It, you know, a bottle of water in like the Haiti earthquake or the hurricanes that have happened now, giving somebody a bottle of water is the 5-minute throwaway disposable solution. Now you have millions of empty plastic bottles, and in a disaster, what are you going to do with those? So, you know, clearly having filters in stock by the relief agencies would be the solution, but they don't do that. So then they come running and they go, look, we want to spend, you know, $250,000 at your facility, but they want to pay absolute rock bottom base price, which, you know, in relief, that would be okay. But in the entire United States, there's not enough product of anybody selling, let alone things that would work in an emergency. Remember that the black filters, the black carbon-based filters, are a carved product. They take a block of carbon, which in a sense developed out of packing material, and carve a cylinder out of it, slap a plastic base on it and call it a filter. It's not a filter, it's an absorber. And the problem is, I used to sell these, and they're rough on the edges. There's probably about 10 companies that sell these types of filters now. But for emergency, they don't work because they plug up the first time and you can't clean them. The ceramic filters, like I sell, are cleanable. You just rub them a little bit. You could rub them even with your fingers if in emergency, or if you had even a stick or a, you know, butter knife, or like I say, even your fingers. You don't need a Scotch-Brite pad. If you're in your kitchen and everything's rosy, then you might use a little Scotch-Brite pad that you use only for that, like I do. I have a little Scotch-Brite pad that I dry out each time and put back in the little plastic package and keep it there for just rubbing the water filter. But the black carbon filters are not cleanable, or absorbers, are not cleanable. And so they really are not a big benefit in an emergency. You give somebody one of those, and it's not really going to be very effective. So the end result is we had a shot, not really containers, but filter elements. And of course, we try to comply with those emergency requests, but that's pretty much over now. And we're back to normal, whatever that is, until the next disaster hits. But we've been trying to get these relief agencies to stock up and buy in advance and put in warehouses and have filters ready so they can quick put them there. And they don't do it. They won't invest the money until there's an emergency. And then, of course, the people are waiting weeks or months for supplies that are inadequate, because there's not enough of them. You can't, nobody just carries thousands and thousands and thousands of units on the shelf in case an emergency happens. And, you know, it's a fairly efficient industry. We keep ahead. There are times when all of a sudden we get blasts of orders and, okay, we can fill them, but you know, it's not an industry with a major amount of profit. It's a fairly lean industry, but also for mine, they're manufactured in the USA. You don't have to wait for them to come from India on the banana boat. Anyway, enough of that, but just letting people know that some things have happened in the background, and we're recovered from that. And back to normal. But like I say, they really didn't take containers that much, but mainly filter elements. So they're apparently relying on some kind of containers that they have there. And God knows what they might be using, you know, old paint cans. It's absurd, these relief agencies. I really get angry at them. And, I could go into that, what happened in Haiti, etc. But I just wanted to recount that little incident. Another issue is that if you want to take a nice vacation, how would you like to go to Luxembourg this weekend? Or how would you like to go to Boulder? Even a nice local place. Maybe Miami Beach or even to China next year. You know, plan a nice trip to China. Well, you can do all of this if you get a PhD in science. Get a nice government agency job, and you can fly all over the world on what I call scientific vacations. And they're very lucrative. I mean, you get the pretty much the royal treatment. You get nice hotel accommodations, field trips to go to see nice, they plan out the field trips so you can go and do things. And I've gone on these, but I pay my own way. When I do this and go to the scientific meetings, I pay my own way, you know, and I have in the past, and I've learned I don't go to many of these anymore because you're dealing with tier two science, and you may as well just go walk over against the wall there and pound your head on it. Brick wall would be easier than a wooden wall because it's harder, and you'd get about as much success. Because you're dealing with tier two scientists, they're really very poor scientists. And what they learned in a textbook 20 years ago is kind of burnt into their brain cells, and that's all they can think. They don't have the ability to reason or to understand that what they're doing is just purely ridiculous, and they don't have the ability to understand that what they learned in a textbook was just garbage science. So it's a system. For example, let's take the moon Io of Jupiter. Jupiter has a massive magnetic field, and there's an electric current that's measured between Io and Jupiter. Saturn has a similar moon with similar. It's Enceladus at Saturn is the moon that's got the major electrical current coming back to Saturn. It's a return current sheet. And it's due to the fact that both Jupiter and Saturn have very significant proton winds. They're little stars. And so these objects are discharging the fusion-based capacitors, and that's where the electrical current comes from. But standard science has it backwards. They go, oh, this is due to a magneto effect. And in an automobile, where you have a charge build up in a little condenser, and then it bridges the gap and causes a spark in a car. The old condenser type ignition systems for automobiles. You have a coil, and that is the coil contains wire, and the current, you send a jolt of current through this wire on one side of the coil, and then there's a like a transformer, so it jumps up the spark to a high voltage, and then that little bit of current is enough to jump the spark plug gap and cause the spark. But see, all of this is contained in wires. And in outer space, you don't have wires. So the magneto type of effect cannot happen in outer space because the currents are not contained in wires. And so they have it all backwards. And they don't realize this, but as I said, you're dealing with scientists that don't understand science. So when you go to a scientific meeting like American Geophysical Union meeting or many of the other more local meetings that are basically, say, for solar physics or for space weather physics, etc. By the way, my paid cast now, I'm dealing with the topic of weather and space weather. So you might want to check that out if you're not a regular monthly member in the paid cast. That's the current topic based on my weather book and then other information. So that's the current series going on in the paid cast. So you can learn how electricity in outer space works. And ultimately, this week's episode is dealing with the manipulation of weather on Earth. But it took 7 lessons to get to that point. Okay. Anyway, a little plug for the paid cast. And there's still a sale on the upsales of my books, book library, ebook library, etc. Okay, enough of that. But back to the scientific vacations. So being a tier two scientist you're not going to get rich on it. You're going to live a comfortable life. You're going to, every year, annually, you're going to beg for government funding, write letters to your congressman about how important your work is. And then you get grants, you get to publish in the peer-reviewed Tier 2 science journals, which is pure garbage, and you get to fly around to meetings all over the world and rub elbows with your buddies from all over the world, and they get to schlock around with you, and they're all on the same level, and they don't, of these, say, 17 to 20,000 people at an American Geophysical Union meeting in all branches of science, none of them have a clue that there's an entire layer of science above them of which they know nothing, which is real science. And they're the paid layer that's necessary to give the illusion of real science. That's, like the top tier two scientists might be Neil deGrasse Tyson or Carl Sagan back in the old days. These are tier two scientists. And one time I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting, and the speaker was talking about his work on solar physics. And he said they have to send all of their data and analysis up to the military, which is tier one science. At least this guy had a clue that there was a level up there. And somebody in the audience asked, what do they respond to you? Do they like your work? Do they approve of it? Is it good? Or whatever. And so this speaker responded, and he says, they never tell us anything. They don't tell if it's good or bad or indifferent. They never tell us if they use it. They never tell us anything. So that gives you an inside look into tier two versus tier one science. But my point is that if you're a tier two scientist, you run around, you go to meetings, you get flown all over the place. You don't book any of this. Your secretary does. That's the secretary's job. So these guys live kind of a little royalty life, and they're very important because they give the image of science being done. And so, you know, plate tectonics or dirty snowball comet models or the idea that there's solar fusion is at the core of the sun, all of these incorrect ideas get promoted year after year, decade after decade, and century after century. And that's the way it's going to go. So there's not a lot of point in going and talking to these people because they're just not there. They're just not there. You talk to them and you get kind of a blank stare, kind of like, you know, that's what you get. You get a blank stare. That's the best way I can describe it. Okay. Onwards and discussing, well, the hurricane season, is it going to continue? According to Mishukaku, there's still lots of warm water out there and there could still be hurricanes. To have seven major hurricanes in a row that all make landfall and all do major damage, the odds of that are about the same as rolling sevens all night at Las Vegas. Not going to happen. So that's another indication that the hurricane season that we're seeing is manipulated. It's just out over the top manipulated. And there's looking at solar storms and looking at the other things that you might expect that would be sources of energy for hurricanes is simply not there. I mean, we're hard-pressed to get a decent aurora going, let alone, and there's, you know, the storms are like G-level storms on the sun. The sun is about as quiet as a church mouse. And it's the electrical component of the sun, which NASA and the space weather aficionados in the government, that's what they discuss and measure and report. Just, you know, there's no energy in the sun at all. So, and there's certainly no electrical energy because I look for the side effects and they're simply not there. So the hurricane season this year, safe to say, simply manipulated. And I've noticed that my shows, my interviews, have been pretty much spread widely. It's getting a bit of notoriety just in the general press. And it's about time that people are waking up. Sometimes I'm misquoted. Sometimes they draw, you know, conclusions that I might not totally agree with. But, you know, what's funny, too, is a lot of times these people will report on me and they don't call me up or email me. I'm not difficult to get a hold of. They don't call me or contact me for an interview. But they take some interview that I've done, you know, write about it, which is good. I guess if that's the way reporting goes today, it's very sloppy work. Because somebody can quick write an article, put it online, and that's the end of it. So, interviews with various people, I've had quite a few, we have gotten a bit of notoriety. So that's good. It's about time.
Now I just want to give a quick update on Pluto. There's some announcements that have come out at this third grade level science, it's called Science at NASA, and they try and hype up animated pictures of etc. But they've finally admitted that Pluto has an atmosphere. Now this is a very interesting observation or revelation, let's put it that way. You could see this in the photos of Pluto. Now, this is the farthest planet in the solar system, and it is a planet. But you could see this in the original photos. You could see the layering of atmosphere above the planet, which means it had an atmosphere. Now, it certainly should not have an atmosphere if it's 4.5 billion years old. And, you know, I get a kick out of the lead NASA scientist going, well, we have to go back and, you know, this is going to be a new surprise and, you know, makes things more complex. Yeah, right. But also you can see it snowing in the atmosphere of Pluto, which means it has weather systems. Now, the sun at Pluto is about as bright as a dim flashlight in a London fog at 100 yards. It literally provides no energy to Pluto at all. So Pluto is gaining its energy from the discharge of the solar capacitor. It's a young planet, and it shows how much energy is being distributed or deposited into these planets from the electrical nature of the solar system, because it's not solar light. There's just it's the sun at that location looks like a kind of a bright star. And by the way, this topic I'm dealing with also in my paid cast. The last week's show dealt with show dealt with the outer planets from Jupiter to Pluto. And so I discussed the reality that Pluto has an atmosphere. It had a comet coma around it. As the New Horizons spacecraft approached from a distance, you could see Pluto and its two moons, Charon and its other second moon, with comet comas, actually comet tails surrounding them. And so these weather systems are part of the basically the discharge of the solar capacitor. I'd recommend, for a lot of detail on this, go to my paid cast. And in this ongoing series, Weather, Space Weather, and the Solar System, I talk about that. But snow on the surface of Pluto. It turns out that Pluto is a very bright planet because it's covered with snow. And so to snow, it needs an atmosphere. It needs a weather system. It needs warming, and to even have an atmosphere. Now, that's an interesting detail in itself. Now, NASA, through its measurements, would know exactly the composition of the atmosphere of Pluto, but they're not talking. Because if it contains water, then water should be crystallizing out at, you know, relatively high temperatures. So what is this snow composed of? When we say snow, we mean water ice. The crystals that form from H2O, or what we call water. That would mean that Pluto's atmosphere is warm. That means that the water vapor has to get up in the air before then it crystallizes, and it then has to have dust particles. It has to have a vertical electric field because the ice crystals, snow crystals, don't form unless there's an electric field. So this means many, many things for little planet Pluto that certainly you wouldn't expect. So on the video that I saw, it was a science at NASA, and they show Alan Stern's face and quote him as saying, "Well, this is more complicated than what we thought." Yeah, Alan, a lot more complicated than what you thought. Anyway, very important scientific news there. At least NASA has admitted there's an atmosphere. Now they got a problem to try and explain it, something that supposedly existed from the beginning of the solar system, and it still has active weather. And so anyway, let me diverge a little bit here on the planet Pluto. It's not a remnant of a 4.5 billion year old solar system. And that age for the solar system, let me just give you a little heads up on how they determine that. They take rocks and they take isotopic concentrations of various minerals, and they do measurements and estimates, and these are all based on assumptions. Or they will take meteorites that fall to Earth or alleged moon rocks, and they measure certain properties, and then they come up with a calculation based on assumptions. And so anyway, that is what's going on there, that they make a measurement and then make an estimate, and then they say, without any proof or further measurement, that Pluto falls into that same category and is thus 4.5 billion years old. assuming that it was part of the original solar system, because they have no idea how a planet could form out there all by itself. Well, the plasma discharge comet model, my work on how solar systems develop, shows that planets can come in and develop at any time. And also in that far region of the solar system, the planets are in an ongoing formative state. In other words, the comet process is still underway. Now, that's really important because that does explain Pluto's young age. It explains its the fact that it's got warmth. It's got, if you look at the surface of Pluto, it has areas that just fall in. They're like caverns that just fall inwards. They're like a bubble that comes up, and then there's no support for the land, and so it just falls in, kind of like sinkholes. And these are visible, big enough to be visible from outer space. There's a lot of these, and so what that means is the underground geology of Pluto is, the heat is coming from within. So that means Pluto had been a comet with heat of formation that was recent, because if it was 4.5 billion years old, then none of that residual heat would still be there. You can also see this on Pluto with the bubbling of the surface. There are regions that it looks like oatmeal being made in the morning. It's bubbling. There's regions that are falling in. There are landslides. There's geological activity. None of this would happen if this were an aged, completely frozen planet. But it's new, it's got an atmosphere, it has a comet tail, it has snow coming out of the atmosphere. And let me just also mention something about the snow. More than likely, most of the snow that falls never re-evaporates into the air to create snow again. So the snow is coming in from the comet tail, if you see what I mean. The tail is attracting water or other chemicals. When they talk about snow, they're not saying what the snow is made of, but the implication is that it is water because it is white. And of course, carbon dioxide, what we call dry ice, ice without water, which is actually colder than water ice, is also white. So it could be carbon dioxide snow. We don't have enough answers out of NASA to make any type of descriptive analysis here, which is unfortunate because they have the data. They have the spectroscopic data. They know what's falling from the sky in on the planet Pluto. They know what it is. But they're just they have these little four-minute science at NASA animated briefs, and that's supposed to wow you and keep you sending your dollars through your congressman to support them. Okay, well, on to the main science topic. We're talking about ancient sounds from outer space. Just a quick word here. The Paidcast, as mentioned before, weather, space weather, and the solar system. That's the ongoing series. So if you have not joined yet, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and join at $3.95 per month. So that's like on a month with four Thursdays, that's less than a dollar per show. And if we have five Thursdays in a month, then you get it for about 75 cents a show, which is try and go to the movies for that. Go to the webpage and join that. Also, just want to remind you that we had that brief hiatus because of the emergency relief issues with the water filter business, but everything's in stock. We're shipping. We're pretty much through the relief aspect of sending out equipment for relief. And bar any other disasters, that should pretty much end that until next year, to the when they manipulate more storms into who knows where. Okay, so ancient storms or ancient, I'm sorry, ancient sounds from outer space. Now, this is interesting because we have a variety of sounds, and the ancients talk about this. The rumbling of the earth, and these are not all of them come from outer space, but the rumbling of the earth is one in which, after the great Venus event, which shook the earth tremendously, there was the earth would rumble. It would just make noise, like groaning noises, and along with earthquakes. So, and this was as a result from outer space, that basically the large comet Venus passed by Earth, sending the gravitational waves into the surface of the Earth, shook the Earth, caused a pole shift. So you can imagine the amount of wrenching and just colliding of plates and land waves, the changing of waterways, melting of great glacier areas which had been glaciated in the reformation or the formation, the new formations of new glaciers that had never been there before. All of this going on in a single couple-week period, so a tremendous amount of activity. But the ancients talked about the underground rumbling. And so what would that sound like? The earthquakes, you can hear them. You can hear earthquakes. They make noise. And, of course, I've been in a few of these major ones in the last number of years. So that was quite an experience. But there's a lot of noise. And, of course, if you're around people, there's a lot of screaming. But the buildings shaking and the ground making noise. And all of this is a result of the Venus event, the most recent event, possibly other events. But that's the Venus event being the most recent, jarring the earth and causing tremendous amount of underground, basically, movement. But there are various types of earthquakes. There's the vertical earthquake in which you're like, the earth is moving up and down in a vertical direction. It's very hard to stand when that's going on. In fact, most people are thrown to the ground when you try and walk. The ground isn't there, and when you try and bring your foot up, the ground comes up to slap you. So it's really difficult to walk under conditions like that. So what people do is they run out of their house or building that they're in, run into the street as far as they can get, and then simply fall down. And then you're subject to the ground basically coming up and hitting you. So you're laying on the ground, and the ground is coming up, slapping you in the face, and you're basically bouncing your whole body around. But underneath, you can hear that. It sounds like a terror movie, and if you're in one of these, that's exactly what it is. It's the real-life terror movie. So the ancients talk about the rumbling ground. They talk about the boiling waters, and that's something else. Now, remember that in the Noah days, Noah talked about the water gushing up out of the ground. And what is that all about? That is the when the floodwaters begin, the pressure on the underground water systems becomes great enough to where, for example, pressure on a lake, an existing lake, pushes down, and the artesian wells that are associated with that lake then basically explode up through the surface because of the pressure. So the ground then looks like a fountain with the water pouring out, and that's a result of the influx of more water. The sound of tsunamis. Now here's another sound. These are all earth sounds. The sound of tsunamis. The ancients talked about Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the Mayas, carrying the ocean on his back. And that was their descriptive terminology for the understanding that, you know, normally the ocean isn't just racing across the land, but due to Quetzalcoatl, which was basically Venus in their mythology, with the nose always having the nose, the sunward spike coming out of the mouth, always seen with a twisted tongue coming out and causing the tsunamis. But a tsunami makes a tremendous amount of noise. So the ancients talk about this. These apparently were observed and discussed by the ancients. Okay, so these are effects within the earth or bodies of water on the earth. But what about in the heavens themselves? Now we start getting closer to that when you talk about, for example, the burning bush or the pillar of fire. These were Moses events. The burning bush had basically a fire, but obviously it was an electrical fire. It burned, the bush appeared to be burning, but it did not consume the bush. So a typical fire, of course, would consume a bush in no time. But the burning bush that was not consumed, we're talking about an electrical fire and electrical discharge. And so basically this would be in an electrically active region where the atmosphere was very electrically active. It was up on a mountainside. So what does that tell you? It's elevated. It's in a region where it's receiving more than, say, electrical activity that you would find down on ground level. And so the burning bush, and of course there was sound associated with that, a crackling noise, etc. So, and that's where the Ten Commandment plates came from. They were allegedly burned into the rock plates by the same fire that burned the burning bush. Another event, and now we're getting closer to outer space type activity. I should just mention one here, is after the Noah's Flood. This is not a sound, but this is an observational. And you have to understand that Noah was probably not a plasma physicist. He probably didn't have laboratory knowledge of prisms or water effects. After the Noah's Flood, the rainbow appeared in the sky for the first time. Remember, they had never seen a rainbow prior to the Noah's Flood. And so the flood occurs, they land on dry land, you go through the whole story, they start to get out, and God puts a rainbow in the sky, is the story. So that means that the atmosphere had changed significantly to where there were no rainbows previous to that, and after the Great Flood, there were rainbows. So what do we have? We have an atmosphere that probably was much denser before the Great Flood, much higher water content, and allegedly the people lived much longer time periods. So the rainbow, although that's not associated with a sound, it's another effect of the Great Flood of Noah being a comet. We passed through the comet tail of a great comet, and remember that I calculated, it's in my, I believe it's in the Planet X book, in the appendices, I talked about the passage through Hale-Bopp, that if we had passed through the tail of Hale-Bopp at the size it was measured to be, it would have taken about 40 days and 40 nights, the duration of the Noah's Flood. So very clearly, these are numbers that just like circumstantial evidence. So then let's go to the Moses event, and remember that the Noah event preceded the Moses event by many thousands of years. So these were totally unrelated, but in time, but related in the fact that these were cometary interactions. In the case of Noah and the Noah's Flood, we simply passed through the tail of the comet and had a tremendous pollution event with water, primarily flooding. But the Moses event was a bit different. We did not go through the tail. We probably went more along the nose side of the comet. There was some influx of water. And the remember the red hand of death, which I've said before, was a result of sulfur dioxide. In other words, the comet tail connected into the region near Earth, Jupiter, and therefore drew in the sulfur dioxide, which is in the region of Jupiter. And when Earth interacted with the comet, we picked up the sulfur dioxide, therefore the red hand of death. So it was like a streaming in and then a curling down so that it looked like a hand. And that was associated with the comet. And, of course, the poisons from the comet. Comets have arsenic. They have, oh, my goodness, a very long list of volatile chemicals that have breathed in, or if, you know, it got on the skin, for example, it could cause serious infections, burns, and death. And so anyway, another space-based visual event associated with death and destruction, so to speak, but there again, not involved with earthquakes, not involved with volcanic eruptions necessarily, but just action at a distance, quite a distance where it was close enough that we were able to pick up that sulfur dioxide. But then remember the plagues of Moses, all of these were related to activity next to a comet. And if you had one such trauma in, you know, at Earth as Earthlings, then you could say, oh, that might have been due to something else. But the fact that there were seven plagues and all of them can be explained by the passage of a large comet. And by the way, I just go into detail on this on my 2-CD set, The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. I talk specifically about the Moses event. And so I go into a bit more detail there. But I'm just including it here because I'm discussing what the ancients saw and witnessed and then passed down to us. Okay, so the Moses pillar of fire. Here's where we get into direct electrical contact with extra solar system objects. And in this case, the pillar of fire was the electrical discharge between the comet and the surface of Earth. And so it would have looked like basically a hurricane, a very tightly wrapped hurricane. And the 1950s movie with Charlton Heston, the Moses movie, Moses and the Ten Commandments, did a very wonderful depiction of that. So I encourage you, if you have not seen that, take a look at it. The Moses and the Ten Commandments movie. But the swirling tornado reaching up into the sky, the burning pillar of fire. Now, there's another interpretation of this, and that is that the pillar of fire, which was the comet, guided the Israelites for 40 years and 40 nights in the desert. They followed it. And for some reason, they were able to pick up food every morning that they called manna, and were able to eat. But nobody reports really encountering this material. We don't really know much about it other than it came from the sky and it was edible and it sustained them. So, back to the pillar of fire. Let me just go through the dynamics of a tornado. In a regular Earth tornado, the cloud system builds up. The thunder clouds, the clouds that typically house a tornado can be as much as 100,000 feet high. So that's about, give or take 20 miles, just approximate. So that's about a third of the way to outer space. So those clouds can connect into the ionosphere electrically. And when they do, the electrical currents start to flow in the ion currents flow up. And so that's the main cause of tornadoes on planet Earth. But if you get an electrical discharge from outer space, then the discharge is doing basically the same thing. It's ionizing the air around the ground area. That air then is free to move in the electric field. It goes up the column. It goes up the region where the electrical discharge is occurring, and it spins. And that's why if you're close to a tornado, it has lightning up the center of it. A lot of times you'll see lightning outside the tornado. And so these effects they're all related to electricity. But the pillar of fire was from the comet nucleus. This was a nucleus that was charged up to a different potential than planet Earth. And as a result, the spiral movement, the helical movement, as the ionized gas moved up the column in the electrical circuit, then caused the pillar of fire, as they called it. Now, would there have been a sound associated with this? Well, absolutely. This would have been basically a roaring, large tornado and being driven, and it would be something that the people could see. But what about the sound? What would this sound like? We all know what earthbound tornadoes sound like, and if you don't, you can go to the YouTube channel and just look up tornado footage, and you can hear what a tornado sounds like. They're really, really noisy. People that have been close to them say that it sounds like a freight train coming by, but not just coming by. It's like coming right by you, like, 5 feet away. So the tremendous amount of noise, rumbling noise, but also high-pitched noise a lot of times because of the high wind. The interaction of the wind with material that gets sucked up into the tornado. So a lot of noise, a lot of basically like a giant vacuum cleaner, because that is exactly what it is, a giant vacuum cleaner. And then the one that Moses was involved with was immense. And the story is that this thing sat there for a while. It didn't just pass by and go away. It lasted a bit. So the discharge from the comet as it moved by was sustained for a good period of time. And the way they saw it on the ground was that it protected them from the forces of the Pharaoh. And of course, those chariots were found in the sea. Now there's been some mixed reporting on that recently, but I remember when National Geographic did a story on that. Now the mainstream fake news media is trying to deny that story, saying that, it never happened. But in fact, I remember seeing that story, and National Geographic would not cover a story that was bogus or somehow made up. They deal with professional photographers all the time. And so that, to me, is a very believable story. So along with this, now, there are pictures we have of, for example, the electrical signature around, let's say, Neptune. The electrical signature of an electrical contact from outside the planet. And then there's a ring around that, and that ring is like an auroral ring. Now, if you look at the North Pole of Earth, and there's a satellite up there that looks at the auroral region of Earth all the time, you can see that it's kind of a ring, but it's denser in some areas than other, and it moves around all the time. It spins around the North Pole. But I've been in auroras where the auroras are really, really very heavy. The one night I remember, it was a full moon. I was up on a lake. There was a full moon. It was a very clear night, and you could hear the waves. The waves were very large because of a wind, but the auroras were audible. You could hear the noise of the aurora borealis was kind of a hissing noise. So that's what the aurora borealis sounds like. It's very important to know that there's a lot of energy coming in there. And typically, the high-energy particles coming into Earth are deflected by the Earth's magnetic field. But in the case of the auroras, the charged particles come right down parallel to the magnetic field into the north and south poles, and in fact can be accelerated because there's an electric field there. But they could be actually accelerated into this region and obtain very high energies. So those secondary particles that are the ones that typically reach Earth, and they might be generated, might be two or three or four generations of charged particles that come down through the atmosphere. And once I was working on a deck up in the Northern Woods region, and it was a beautiful blue clear day. There's no clouds, not a single cloud in the sky. And I could hear this mist, this rain falling. And I looked up, there were no clouds. Then I realized that these were probably electrons, or certainly, or they were secondary charged particles that came from an initial blast that would have been high up in the atmosphere. But it sounded like rain. But imagine small raindrops that were coming in at very high velocity. That's what it sounded like, hitting the leaves of the trees. And I could look out, and it wasn't only audible, I could see the leaves fluttering as if they were hit by rain particles. So very interesting, another sound. But here let's get into some of the sounds that the ancients talk about that are really, really loud sounds. And let's go back, first of all, to the psychology of, say you were running an investigation. And I started out talking about the Bigfoot. Someone would claim they had seen a Bigfoot or experienced a Bigfoot at close range. And if they're taken into hypnosis, what the psychologist is looking for is smells and sounds, because your mind can make up images. And that's the problem. I mean, people could have flashbacks from a bad dream or from other effects, just hallucinatory effects. Some people's brains have problems, etc. But people can have illusions of seeing things, but you cannot make up something that you have never heard or smelt before. And that's where you separate the men from the boys, so to speak, in terms of investigation. So when we hear the ancients talking about the trumpeting sound, which is littered throughout the Bible, the trumpeting, and when they're talking about the end days, or they're talking about seeing activity up in the sky, they're always talking about activity up in the sky. And so when they're talking about that trumpeting noise, it's really, really loud. In fact, in the Colburn is very clear that after one of these events, that the people were deaf. They had the noise was so loud during the event, the close passage of a large comet passing the Earth. And in the Colburn, they talk about the monsters, the sky monsters, which when they describe them are clearly comets. But the sound, this screeching sound, or this trumpeting or thumping sound, these are related to electrical discharge that are connecting with our upper atmosphere. And so the sound is carried through the atmosphere, but it's generated in the very upper regions of the atmosphere. So you have pulsed electrical discharges. And, of course, if you've ever heard lightning, imagine lightning, which is an atmospheric troposphere phenomena down in the region where we have Earth weather, down at the surface of the Earth. Lightning causes what the thunderclaps are associated with lightning bolts, And in fact, you've probably seen or done this where you measure the distance to the lightning bolt by counting the seconds. First of all, see the flash. Then you count the seconds and multiply that by the speed of sound in feet per second. You can tell how many feet away the lightning strike was. And sometimes it could be many miles away. So the sound of lightning, the sound of electrical discharges, and then that trumpeting sound where the basically a high frequency sound that's coming in. And remember, sound is related to frequency. So the high-pitched sounds, the trumpeting, these are all the sounds that we associate with musical instruments. So the drumming sound, the thumping sound, the reverberation sound, there's a instrument that's used in Australia. It's called a didgeridoo. It's a long piece of wood that's on the end of a string, and you spin it around, and it creates a very low-frequency sound, typically at the very low end of the audible range for human beings, which is about maybe 30 to 40 cycles per second. And that carries for a very long ways along the ground. That's a method of communication. So the very high-frequency sounds do not go far in air. The very low-frequency sounds carry for a tremendous distance. And so the sound that you hear from something that at a distance possibly has a very different sound than it would have if you were right next to it. But this is what the ancients are talking about. And not just a little bit of noise, but tremendously loud. You find the prophets, as they talk about the end days, etc., talk about the trumpeting. Listen for the trumpeting, look for the signs in the heavens, etc. So they're clearly talking about celestial events. Anyway, hope that gives you a little bit of background on sound that could affect people living down in planet Earth, on the surface of the Earth, coming from outer space. Just once again, if you have not joined the paid cast, please do so. And then the upsales are there. You can get my ebook library for a very good price, half price for all of these. And this really is a big help for me. And monthly, more and more people are joining this. And it helps me it allows me to organize my scientific thoughts into very composite series. The current series is 7 long. The Colburn series, by the way, is going to start up again fairly soon. And the science of the Colburn series. I've finished other major series like the Cosmos, the Real Story series. That's just a wonderful series, all included when you buy all of the episodes going back to August 2016. And also the water filters, still 10% sale. All of that on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.